Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here once again on the program David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And once a month on a Friday, he's here to talk about personal finance. He begins by making a few comments, and then we can take questions on whatever he's got to say here or anything else that has to do with investing in money management. And I'm sure if you have some specific questions about your own situation, you can call us, and he will see if he can help you out. Otherwise, we'd say welcome back to the show. Glad to have you here once again.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. First, I would like to take this opportunity to wish all of the WILL family and listening audience a very joyous and healthy holiday season. And of course, at the same time, most of us are tremendously concerned about the economy, the massive job losses that continue unabated, the erosion of residential real estate values, escalating foreclosures, and a global stock market, well, that has shed almost 50% of its value since December 31 of last year. Almost everyone who is a stock or mutual fund investor has suffered losses anywhere from 25 to 70% of their portfolio as compared to valuations of just 1 year ago. And against this backdrop, I thought it might be instructive to take a few minutes to discuss two very common situations facing many Americans. First, the case of a retired couple. Their situation? They may be in their early 70s, and just this year, due to the stock market, they have probably lost a third or more of their retirement funds that were invested in equities. Maybe they even have a smaller loss in bond funds as well. They probably receive Social Security income, maybe $20,000 a year, used to a reasonable standard of living, perhaps some travel, visiting friends, family, maybe traveling to the Southwest to visit family, children, etc. And of course, the $64 question is, well, we know we should adjust our standard of living. Our investments, after all, have dropped dramatically from just over a year ago. But how much should we cut back? How much is safe to withdraw from our investments? Should we exit the stock market, for example? And a second scenario, a single woman, perhaps a single man, the situation, age 57, hoping to retire at age 62 or 63, lives in Illinois, maybe makes $50,000 a year, and every month has contributed religiously to that 401k account. About 70% of it used to be in stocks and stock mutual funds, about 30% in bonds, a fairly reasonable allocation before retirement. And probably that allocation and that fund has dropped some 40% in value. Can you imagine such a hit? Well, the goals obviously were to secure a retirement, hopefully retire before age 65, ensure that this individual is not a financial burden to children, family, etc. And again, the $64 question, I've accepted that I'll have to delay my retirement, but will I even be able to retire at 65? I've stayed in the market so far, but things don't seem to be getting a whole lot better. Should I bail out now? I think these are the kinds of questions that are on almost everyone's mind. But before I can intelligently address each of these situations in their individuality, let's be very clear about some fundamental financial concepts that I've talked about many, many times before. First of all, your biggest financial enemy is not the stock market. Rather, our biggest financial enemies are running out of money before we run out of life. In other words, our real enemies are longevity risk, that's living a heck of a long time, and purchasing power risk, the value of our dollar precipitously disappearing each day. Now, obviously, we are living longer. In fact, if you are 65 today, the actuaries tell us that there is at least a 50% likelihood that you will live well into your mid or late 80s. And if you are a married 70-year-old couple, as in our first case, there is at least a 25% probability one of you will live into your 90s. Interestingly enough, the most rapidly growing decile of population in the U.S., at least in a percentage sense, are folks between ages 91 and 100. So, David, they're catching up to us. They're marching on. They're voting. So even 70-year-olds need to plan for a minimum of 20 to 25 years of life expectancy. And against this backdrop, generally each day our dollar purchases less goods and services because of inflation. Now today, of course, in the short run, we're in a bit of an exception. We're a bit of an anomaly because we are currently experiencing some deflation, especially in asset values, commodity prices, for example, in the agricultural sector, the energy sectors, as well as the easing of retail prices. However, This is likely a short-lived phenomenon, and these price drops have not been particularly reflected in the delivery of medical services or food costs, two pretty big items on our hit parade. At an annual inflation rate of 4%, for example, our dollar is worth just 50 cents in 18 years. And at a 5% inflation rate, our dollar is halved in just 14 years. And an awful lot of economists think that inflation is again around the corner as we continue to print and print and print money and loan it out with the hope of it being repaid. Now, against this backdrop, because of longevity and purchasing power risk, the single biggest mistake older investors make is dropping out of the stock market entirely. In my view, even retired Americans should have at least somewhere between 30 and 40% of their liquid portfolio in a diversified stock portfolio. And historically, remember that stocks have represented one of the last means and one of the best means to deal with purchasing power risk over very long periods of time. So let's go back, examine the case of a retired couple in their 70s. Their portfolio is hemorrhaged. First, remember that one of the spouses is very likely to live into the 90s. So our time horizon may well be even 20 years. And when we adopt a 20-year time horizon, stocks become a far more palatable investment as stock market volatility smooths out over long periods of time. Second, I would suggest the following asset allocation to this 70-year-old couple. First, 40% in diversified stocks and stock mutual funds, 55% in short-term fixed income with maturities of no greater than 4 years, and approximately 5% in cash and cash equivalents, such as savings, checking, and money market accounts. Now, I'm choosing this particular asset allocation for a number of reasons. First, it is very similar to the asset allocation recommended by the American Council on Gift Annuities. Now, they are the most prominent organization in the world which recommends gift annuity rates to charitable organizations, such as the University of Illinois, such as foundations that you can purchase a gift annuity from. The expected long-term return on this portfolio is about 5.75% on an annualized basis. Second, if one withdraws 4% annually from this portfolio and increases the annual withdrawal by the consumer price index each year, there is a greater than 90% certainty that the portfolio will never be exhausted during the joint lives of this 70-year-old couple. So my recommendation would be for our couple to withdraw 4% of their investment portfolio in 2009, coupled with Social Security and any other investment income they have. And more importantly, these two sources of income are adjusted annually for inflation, thereby preserving purchasing power. Social Security, of course, is automatically adjusted, and the portfolio distribution is annually increased by the rate of inflation. Also, it is very important, when a couple retires, they are basically debt-free. The number one financial difficulty seniors often face is an outstanding mortgage on their personal residence when they retire. Not only is the monthly payment very burdensome, but also it inhibits the practicality of a reverse mortgage, which can become an important source of cash flow for a retired individual. Now, in the case of our single woman, currently age 57, perhaps a single man, as a result of the markets, this portfolio is now likely to be about a 50-50 portfolio, as opposed to 70% in stocks and 30% in bonds before the recent downturn in the stock market. Here's my advice. Number one, don't abandon the stock market for all the reasons we've already talked about. Two, continue to maximize 401k contributions, certainly to obtain the maximum match from your employer. Three, invest 50% of your monthly 401k into a diversified stock mutual fund portfolio or stocks, and 50% into relatively short-term fixed income investments. Consider, for example, Treasury inflation-protected securities as a possible option. Four, here's the big one, consider working to normal retirement age, which in this particular case is actually age 66 for Social Security purposes. By retiring at age 62, your Social Security check will be reduced by some 25% from what it would otherwise be at age 66, and that's a very large financial haircut. By working past age 62, you will likely have far better medical insurance coverage, assuming that it is employer-provided. Otherwise, you may well be responsible for excessive medical premiums and even less coverage prior to Medicare eligibility at age 65, especially if you are paying those premiums yourself. And finally, between now and age 66, work with your financial advisor to not only continue to save for retirement, but also work out a mortgage payment schedule so you can actually have a mortgage burning party just before your retirement party. So in both of our cases, because of longevity risk and purchasing power risk, it is important to stay committed to stocks as they still represent a solid inflation hedge over long, long periods of time. And finally, David, each month we review the results of our equity couch potato portfolio, which consists of 8 stock indexes or asset class funds. The actual portfolio can be accessed on the WILL website. Click on Focus 580, then click on Links, and then click on Couch Potato Portfolio. Well, through last night's close, our portfolio year-to-date, well, it's a negative 41.3%. It's a big number. And this compares with our benchmark, S&P 500, which is a negative 38.4% year-to-date. So even though we have a diversified portfolio across many different indexes, both U.S., international, both large and small, interestingly enough, this is the year to be in the S&P 500. Just big companies, U.S. big companies, are outperforming just about any other asset class, although down 38.4%, you can't get very excited about that particular kind of performance. So it's a very tough stock market indeed. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to tackle our listeners' questions on financial topics of their choice, or of course, something I've raised in my introductory remarks. But the bottom line is if you are in the stock market, do not exit the stock market. The stock market is a long-term play, and there are going to be these abnormal periods of time with abnormal returns, and you're going to have to live through them. So don't bail out now. That would be certainly my advice.
All right. Well, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And just let me mention, on the website, I think that this is still the case, that we're working on a transition between the old site and the new site. And if you were looking for the links, the Focus 580 links, you're going to have to go to the old website, which is will.uiuc.edu. I think if you go to will.illinois.edu, they're not yet there. We're working on getting everything moved over from the old one to the new one. But that's more information you need to know. The important thing is that it's there, but do go to the old site. Again, that's will.uiuc.edu. And also, for people who are interested in the recipes for the cooking shows that we do, they're all there. And it looks like we're all the way caught up to the December show. You know, occasionally people have said, gee, I'd like to have that recipe, and when are you going to have it there? So it's there.
And one other point I wanted to make, while we are still down of almost 40% for year to date, and whether we look at the S&P or the couch potato portfolio, at least that is some improvement over just a month ago where the portfolio was down over 50%. So we've had about a 9% bump since we got together last time. Maybe we'll get lucky again, get fortunate. I'm not in the predicting business, as you know, but maybe there'll be a happy holiday bump as well next time after the new year.
All right. Questions again are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We will start off with someone who is calling in on a cell phone. That's our line number one. Here's the caller. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I tend to think very, very long term, and I'm 40 years old, but, you know, when you talk about living till the mid-80s, that's very interesting to me. I'm wondering how our manufacturing base in our country is actually going to affect long-term macroeconomics. And specifically, I mean, it seems to me that with only a 10%, and this is the number I've heard, please correct me if that's wrong, a 10% manufacturing base, it doesn't seem like we're creating wealth, and it seems like there's going to be less and less wealth to go around as time goes on. And with the massive trade deficit and the federal deficit and the huge debt load that most people are under. I'm wondering how all those factors are going to figure in with your long-term prospects for the United States economy.
Well, you have just given a huge mouthful and probably enough to chew on for 50 different economists. I think one of the points you make is very important, and that is that the United States, very much so over the last 15 to 20 years, has actually discriminated against the manufacturing base in the United States as compared to the financial base in the United States through tax benefits, depreciation benefits, IT benefits. It all benefited the financial services industry really at the expense of the manufacturing industry. And as a result, we had a lot of enabling legislation which really enabled, if you will, tremendous numbers of jobs to be expropriated, especially in the manufacturing base. And indeed, we even have abandoned a great deal of the manufacturing base, let alone looking at – we don't have to look any further than Detroit. All I can tell you is I'm a long-term optimist. All right? We have been through negative periods before. We really don't have to look too far back to the year 2001 and 2002, where the average portfolio, stock market portfolio, dropped 40 to 45%. Some people who were in the high techs dropped 60, 70, 80%. All of that was recovered. And then, of course, we have dropped back again. But the point being, one, I'm an optimist. Two, I think we have a number of tremendous companies. Remember that we still lead the world in patents, trademarks, copyrights, etc. We are still the most innovative economy in the world, and I think that we will recover from this and we will thrive in the future. When that's going to happen, the actual time, whether it's a month, a year, 2 years, 3 years, I'm not in the prediction business, but I think that overall this economy is extremely resilient. And we can see that even in these times, our economy, interestingly enough, at least our stock market, is down less than the European markets, than the emerging markets, than markets around the world. Make no mistake about it, the U.S. is still a global leader, and there is a great deal to be optimistic about in the future.
Well, thank you for addressing that. Have a good day.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to a caller. This is someone on the campus on our line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you think this is a good time to purchase 529 plans. We have three grandchildren that we'd like to get something started for, and I'm kind of looking at this as a way to really get a lot of bang for the buck and expect by the time they need it, things will be rectified and back up. Two of them are 5 and a half and one's 2 years old, and I'd just like to get your feelings on that.
I think it's a great time. I think it's a wonderful time to invest for any grandchild or child for a college education. Now, remember, when we talk about 529 plans, at least if you are located in the state of Illinois, there are two types of 529 plans. You're really talking about the second type of plan where you're going to take a sum of money, invest it, probably in stocks, bonds, and securities, let it grow, and then it can be utilized for any college purpose tax-free for that child when that child decides to go on for a higher education degree.
Exactly.
So there are any number of providers that you can look at. I would work with a low-cost provider. 529 plans, of course, are state-sponsored plans. So the states then give you the number of providers. You can go to the Vanguard website, the Fidelity website, the Schwab websites, any of the big websites, and they can tell you what states they work with. Maybe you've already have one chosen, but I think in terms of your timing, and I'm not a timer, but certainly we are closer to lows than highs, and you've got all of this wonderful time on your side. We're talking about a 5.5-year-old. You're talking at least, 12, 13 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of time at these stock market valuations to allow your assets to grow. And it seems to me, something else here, there is going to be enormous pressure on major university institutions to continue to dramatically increase tuition and fees. They seem to be dramatically increasing at rates of 7 to 10% annually. I don't see that abating, mainly because the endowments of major institutions have been hit so hard. We read about that every day, where endowments maybe are down 30, 40% on an annualized basis. And a lot of that money was pouring back into scholarships, education, research, grants, faculty, etc. So some of those dollars are going to dry up. Institutions are going to scurry around, and they're going to say, where are we going to get this money? As state-supported institutions, and that state support continues to dwindle. That means much higher tuition and fees, I believe, over the next 10 to 15 years. So a secondary strategy is perhaps to look at something like College Illinois, mm-hmm. where College Illinois, of course, you can buy prepaid tuition. Now, there's some advantages and disadvantages to College Illinois and most of these prepaid tuition programs. One of the advantages, of course, is that you lock in the tuition. You're paying for it for 4 years. You can buy as much as eight semesters, 4 years of tuition. It does not cover fees. Fees are separate, and fees are actually rising just as rapidly as tuition. And typically, the tuition that is covered is for 15 hours. And many, many students take more than 15 hours a semester. But nonetheless, it is still an excellent complement to your other notion of investing directly on a 529 program. So I applaud you. I think your timing is excellent, and you're right on track.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest this morning here on Focus 580 is David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And once a month on a Friday, he's here on the program. We talk about investing in money management. And the idea is if you have a specific question about your own situation and you'd like to get a little bit of advice, you can give us a call, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455.
You know, at the beginning of the show, David, Don DeBeard came on and talked a little bit about the opportunities for charitable giving through IRA charitable distributions. And the IRA charitable distribution rule was actually extended through all of 2009. Now, if you're over age 70 and a half and you have an IRA and you plan to give money to a charity of your choice, there's something called the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. I think that was the name of it. It was passed in 2008, signed by President Bush, and it offers an extension, of the charitable IRA rollover rules that essentially first expired in 2007. And basically what it allows you to do is to direct your IRA funds directly to a charity. You send them directly to the charity. You call your plan sponsor and say, hey, I want to send $5,000 to WILL out of my IRA. And then that $5,000 that you have taken, perhaps as part of your minimum distribution requirement, which can be burdensome, there is no tax on that money. And that's because a lot of people don't need to take all of their minimum distribution. They say, I really don't want to pay tax on it. So a very good and appropriate use of that money is to have it directed to a charity of your choice. So I think that was very apropos. So if you have not taken your 2008, and a few people still have not taken their 2008 minimum distribution, consider giving some of it to a charity of your choice. And again, this option is open to you as well in 2009. But again, don't take the money and have it sent to you and then make the distribution to the charity. Have the distribution taken directly out of your IRA. There's a form that you fill out, and your sponsor will send the money directly to the charity. And I'm sure the charity will give you a big kiss. That's probably my guess. So again, that's certainly worthwhile to consider, a qualified IRA charitable distribution.
Very good. We're at our midpoint here. We certainly have time for other questions. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have some other callers here, and the next in line is in St. Joe on our line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I really like the suggestion of donating that RMD to WLL or other
good
organization. But I'd like to describe to you what our procedure has been and have you determine if there's a smarter way to do it. So so right now we're taking our total RMDs in the final quarter of the year after payouts of dividends and capital gains. And then in late December, we roll over approximately one-sixth of the RMD to our taxable accounts after their payout dates. and then place the balance of the RMD in our joint money market fund, the dollar cost average, to the taxable accounts over the following 6 to 10 months. So I just wondered, is there a smarter way to take a lump sum IRA RMD?
No, I think you're right on point that that's an excellent idea, because then you're avoiding, if there are indeed dividends this year on mutual funds, there's nothing worse than having to pay a dividend. And really all that is just a change in the price of the stock and issuing more shares, but you're taxed on it, but the valuation is the same. So you're really being penalized. So you are waiting till after those dividend distributions. That makes a great deal of sense. One thing that people are doing this particular year is they just hate to hemorrhage their stocks. So as a result, what they are doing is they're asking their IRA sponsor to simply say, all right, I've got to take $5,000 as my minimum distribution this year. Don't cash in $5,000 of stocks. Rather, distribute $5,000 of shares of stock or shares of mutual fund directly to my after-taxable account. So on that basis, I haven't really sold my shares of stock. I still have them. But in any event, I realize that I have to pay tax because it is a minimum distribution. But I've hung on to my position. So some people are doing that as well. Obviously, taking the minimum distribution late in the year makes good sense, especially if you get a little bit of a rise, a little bit of appreciation, a little bit of comeback, if you will, on the stocks that you were currently holding. So I think you're right on point. I think you've got a good program going. I don't have any problem with it. In fact, it makes a good deal of sense.
Good. Glad to hear. Thanks a lot. All right. Best wishes for the new year.
Thank you. Let's go to Monticello for another caller. Line 3. Hello.
Good morning, Doctor. We fit that 70-year-old retired couple example you began with today, and I wonder if you could be a little more specific about that 55% fixed income portion you talked about. For example, would you recommend high-grade corporate bond fund now? And what are your thoughts about buying TIPS now or perhaps in the future? And if in the future, how far down the road? And I'd like to hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay, I'm not a big buyer of corporate bond funds at the moment. So I just think there is still a lot of risk in corporate bond funds. I like certificates of deposit. There are still some very, very competitive rates in certificates of deposit, especially in central Illinois. Interestingly enough, there is still substantial loan demand. So if you really shop, there are some excellent rates. I think that if you are going to buy certificates of deposit, however, I'd stay on the short end at the moment, somewhere between 7 months and no longer than 18 months. I also like TIPS. Interestingly enough, even though TIPS haven't done great this year, they're even. They're dead even, and we can't say that about very many other kinds of investments. So of that 55%, I'd feel pretty comfortable with 30 to 35% of it in certificates of deposit, maybe 20% of it in TIPS, and I would dollar cost average into that position. Remember that TIPS are really what are called Treasury inflation protected securities. They're marketable, and their principal is adjusted by changes in the consumer price index. With inflation, for example, that means a rise in the index, your principal would increase, and with deflation, a drop in the index, the principal decreases. And it's important to understand that relationship between a TIP and a consumer price index. Now, TIPs mature, and the amount of interest that a TIP pays you every 6 months will differ depending upon the consumer price index, but they pay interest at a fixed rate. So maybe you have a TIP that has a coupon rate of 2.5%, but because that 2.5% rate is applied, for example, to adjusted principal, interest payments can vary in amounts from one period to the next. The good news about a TIP is even if we have deflation, that the bottom line is that you always get your original principal back, or the adjusted principal, whichever is greater. So this provision protects you against deflation. TIPS are sold Treasury direct through banks, brokers, dealers. You can go to a mutual fund. You would want to go to a very low-cost provider who specializes in these kinds of mutual funds. TIPS are generally issued in terms of 5, 10, and 20 years. And there is just a lot of opportunity, I think, in the future in tips if you believe after this current period of sort of deflation that we are going to go back into a period of rapid inflation. So if I was a tip buyer, I would probably say, okay, I'm going to allocate X dollars to my tips, and then over the next 12 to 15 months, I would average into my tips. Hope that answers your question. So again, I think CDs, tips, but the major thing is very, very high quality, stay fairly short term.
All right. I hope that helps. Next is someone in Urbana, line two. You're right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The other day I heard the young woman, I don't remember her name, who was doing a canned announcement of the extended emergency IRA distribution program, and she had an error in it, and I listened to it another time, and she had the same error. I mean, obviously, it's a canned. And she claimed that you took the stuff, took your IRA minimum distribution money or whatever, you know, from your IRA directly into the charity. And then you did not pay tax on that because you never received it, which normally minimum required distribution, as you know and say, is taxable. But then she went on to add that it was also tax deductible.
No, it's not.
It's not.
It's clearly not.
So I tried to write to Will, but I ran out of a problem and I didn't do it. I want them to change that because it's really, really wrong. Because that money was never, ever taxed. It was free to begin with. They put it in before they paid tax, or it was deducted from their original income when they put the money in the IRA. What she's saying is true for a Roth, I think, although I don't have a Roth. You with me?
Yes, I understand. Well, the bottom line is that if you have a traditional IRA,
right,
and you have money sent directly to the charity, the bottom line is that the money you send to the charity, one, is not taxed, and two, you take no itemized tax deduction.
Right.
Number two, if you have a Roth IRA, you have already paid tax on that money.
Right.
And essentially then if you give Roth money
right.
to a charity, then you can itemize it.
Right.
Okay, because there is no minimum distribution with a Roth. As a matter of fact, you could be 95 and never take a minimum distribution or any distribution out of a Roth.
Right.
That Roth could then be received by the beneficiary of your choice. It would be subject to federal estate tax as part of the gross estate, but it is not subject to federal income tax.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those are the basic rules. So if there was an error, we'll check on it. But I'm not familiar with that particular program or that particular advertisement. So we'll check, though.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank
you. My pleasure.
Let us continue here. And, Will, we have a message there. Apparently, Donda says that she is aware of the problem and that we'll make sure that it gets changed because we certainly wouldn't want to put out any information. To the best of our knowledge, we wouldn't want to put out any information that was not correct. So thanks to the listener, and we'll take care of the problem. We'll go on here next to Champagne, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question. I retired in June, and so I have earned income for 2008. And I don't know if that's relevant or not to my question. But I would like to know what's the difference between a Roth account and a Roth IRA?
A Roth account is a Roth IRA. Now, there are two types of Roths.
Okay.
There is something called a Roth 401k and a Roth IRA. But when most people refer to a Roth account, they are referring to a Roth individual retirement account. Some employers offer both a traditional 401k, which basically enables you to take money out of your pay, place it into your own retirement, and typically there is some employer match. In addition, you can sometimes take after-tax dollars out of your pay, if your employer allows this program, and put it into a Roth 401k. And that money or that bucket of money would grow tax-free to retirement. If your employer matches on the Roth 401k portion, that goes into a separate bucket of money, so to speak. And when you draw on that eventually at retirement, that portion would be subject to tax. But when we talk typically about a Roth account, we're referring to a Roth IRA.
Okay.
And under current rules, typically people who have earned income, unless you are single and you're making more than about $102,000 to $5,000, or you're married and you're making more than $159,000, you can essentially take $5,000 and put it into your own after-tax retirement Roth IRA. You're not supposed to access it for a good number of years. It's a retirement account. But when you follow the rules and you start accessing it, all of that money is tax-free. And there is no requirement, as I mentioned earlier, that you even have to access it. You could name me as the beneficiary, and then you could give it all to me.
Sure.
You know, that would be a good idea. Or better, probably WILL, or David, perhaps.
Sure.
But David is younger than I am, so he has more years left.
Okay.
Does that help?
That does help. Okay, so if I want to do a Roth IRA, do I have to do it by the end of the calendar year, or do I have until the April 15th?
You typically have till April 15th or when you file your tax return.
Okay.
So you should open your Roth IRA prior to filing the tax return.
Right.
All right?
Right.
So interestingly enough, if you open a Roth IRA, say in March or February, you can contribute for the year 2008, and you can also contribute for the year 2009 if you have earned income in 2009. The only rule about a Roth is you must have earned income, which means salary, bonus, self-employment income. Interest income, dividend income, retirement income, those don't count for purposes of Roth IRA eligibility.
Okay. And 5,000 is the maximum you can do.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. We will continue and talk next with someone in Belgium on our line number. Hold on a second. We got things
Hello?
Gummed up here. Yes, go ahead. Belgium, go ahead.
Yes. Put me in limbo there, didn't you?
I'm sorry. We had too many buttons pushed at the same time here. My bad.
Yes. Mr. Sinha, best of the holidays to you.
Thank you so much.
I hope I'm not covering ground that you guys talked about earlier, but I'd like to visit the situation that's going on with this investment banker in New York. One of the things you definitely say is not to be so unilaterally.
Be diversified.
Don't put all your money in the same place.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Be diversified.
The question I have is, why do we want to worry about these people? They're all very wealthy that put a bunch of money in to maximize their return and look for returns that were just totally out of line with everybody else. And this fella just accomplished their desires and just played funny with their money. And somehow I don't feel at all sorry for anybody involved with this.
Yeah. Well, I first of all don't have a lot of sympathy for people who directly invested with this gentleman seeking these extraordinary year after year after year returns. I have a bit more sympathy for a professional money manager. If I went to a professional money manager who I had a lot of trust in and handled my account, and then that professional money manager turned around and essentially took 90 to 100% of my money and put it with one person. So I had no idea even if I was a reasonably sophisticated client, I'm going to this professional money manager who is giving me an account every month and telling me how I'm doing with no idea. I thought I have a diversified portfolio because it's showing me diversification, but in fact, this person has put all of their money in a fraudulent scheme with one particular manager. And those people I have a bit more sympathy for. But it's the old story, as David and I were talking off the air, the too good to be true rule. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So you're right, and it is ludicrous. It was ludicrous for these major hedge funds to basically take 50, 60, 80, 90% of their money and invest it with one person. It violates every basic financial rule, every basic rule of diversification. So in some senses, you and I are on the same page that we don't have a lot of sympathy for a lot of these people, but there are probably a number of people who really had no idea that their particular money manager was, again, turning around and essentially doing just the opposite of diversification.
And the other point I would like to have you discuss is the fact that the Fed has gone to essentially zero interest rate right now. It doesn't actually get to zero because they have certain charges involved with it, if I understand right.
Correct.
And what in the world is that going to do to us? I mean, zero, we're giving away our money.
Well, we are giving away our money, and you know and I know that somewhere down the road, whether it's a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, we are going to have some serious inflation. We know that. We know that. We just can't simply give money away, print money, without adding additional goods and services and productivity to the economy. It spells a lot of inflation. And that's why if you dollar cost average into tips, for example, over the next 12 to 18 months, that might turn out to be a very, very good investment. But we're on the same page on that one.
Yeah, we just have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers here. David Sino is our guest. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance issues.
I want to make one other point about a Roth IRA. The lady who called about two calls ago, I mentioned that she could put $5,000 into a Roth IRA. Now, if you are over age 50, you could actually add another $1,000, so you could actually get up to $6,000. Somehow, we're considered old people once we're over 50, so we're allowed to catch up and put in another $1,000.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I guess I found myself thinking, I thought that it actually was $6,000, and doesn't that go up
year? It does typically, but in 2009, it's going to be $5,000 plus $1,000.
So it'll be just the same as for 2008. All right. Next caller is Champagne, line two. Hello. Let's call her there, line two.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, I thought it was solved. Anyway, can a child have a Roth IRA if he does, you know, like we'll say 5 years old and does things around the house or a farm or whatever, income?
Yes, if he is reporting income and paying Social Security and Medicare tax on that income, he can have a Roth IRA.
At what level does that start?
Excuse me?
At what pay level does that start? You know, like $700, you know, a per year income or $1,000?
Oh, in terms of Social Security and Medicare?
Yes.
No, on the first dollar. On the first $102,000 of earned income, you pay Social Security, and on the first dollar to the last dollar, you pay Medicare tax. Medicare tax rate is 1.45%. The Social Security tax rate is 6.2%, and the employer pays a like amount. But if you are self-employed, as this young man would probably be, he would get to pay the Social Security and the Medicare twice. So he would be paying 15.3% of his earned income into Social Security and Medicare. So that sometimes dissuades people from opening a Roth IRA.
Okay, one other question. I go to an accountant. He says that I should not draw Social Security at 65, that I could defer that, and if something would happen to me, my wife could, you know, receive an extra earnings or whatever. But is that prudent to do that? Or,
well, first of all, at age 65, is that your normal retirement age?
Yes.
You are at normal retirement age, so you are eligible to draw your full PIA or monthly Social Security check.
But if I do not, my wife can have a bigger portion if I pass on, right?
Well, in a sense. Now, let's think about that. Every year that you would defer and you are currently eligible, and I don't have that chart in front of me, but essentially it's about 7.5%. So in other words, if your monthly amount today, let's just say it was $1,000, and you decided, no, I'm not going to take it today, I'm going to wait another year, then your Social Security would go up by the rate of inflation plus another 7.5%. So theoretically, it is true if something happened to you, your wife would get a larger Social Security amount. On the other hand, you put that decision off. You have then put the decision off of receiving 12 Social Security payments.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Let us continue. Our next caller is someone here in Coles County, line three. Hello.
Decatur, line three.
Oh, well, my apologies. Go ahead.
Okay.
The SEC is not minding the store. They obviously this Madoff thing is one of the deals, but a bigger deal, a much bigger deal than that, is naked short selling. There have been many complaints, railing against the SEC for not minding the store and policing naked short selling, but they're still allowing it. When are we going to stop that?
Well, I don't know. We tried to stop it for 3 or 4 weeks, as you recall, about 2.5 months ago. And
only for select companies.
Only for select companies. That slowed down a little bit of the volatility in the select companies. The real problem is that we have done a horrible job, and this is probably going to change, of regulating the hedge funds, because the hedge funds are the major computer traders who are doing the naked short selling. And you know how this feeds on itself, so that when these stocks start to get dumped and the price gets going down and down and down, the computers then lock in those profits. I agree with you 100%. It should not be allowed. It's horrible. And it puts the average investor like you and I at a tremendous disadvantage, and probably accounts for this huge amount of volatility and these tremendous drops in the stock market at the end of the day in the last 15, 20 minutes, where we see a 200 or 300 point cave-in in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So I'm agreeing with you. The SEC has not minded the store, and it sounds to me like Congress may even get rid of the SEC the way they're talking. So I guess we'll stay tuned and see.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks. And we do have a Coles County caller. This person is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a quick question. You're talking about rolling over a traditional IRA to Roth IRA, and I just want to make sure I've got the right point. You cannot roll that over unless you have earned income, no matter what age you are.
No. Now you're asking a different question.
Okay.
You're saying that I've got a traditional IRA, and I want to roll that traditional IRA into a Roth IRA.
Right.
All right. Now, here's the first rule. The first rule is that you cannot have more than $100,000 of income that you report on your tax return, exclusive, independent of the money that you want to roll from your traditional IRA to your Roth IRA. So you got to figure out whether you're even eligible to roll traditional IRA money to a Roth IRA money. So typically, you look at the bottom line, your AGI, your adjusted gross income. That'll be pretty close to tell you. And if you're over that $100,000 number, forget it.
I got $80,000.
Okay, so you're probably eligible, but check it with your accountant.
Okay.
Number two. Okay. When you roll, and you could maybe even do it at your same brokerage firm, same mutual fund company, set up the account, all of that money then is taxed at that moment. So if you roll in 2008, let's say you roll $25,000 into a Roth IRA, that $25,000 is just additional income that you are going to report and you're going to add on to your other income. So essentially, it'll be taxed at the highest marginal rate you find yourself in. Understand?
I understand that.
Okay. So those are important rules to keep in mind.
Okay.
Once it's in a Roth environment, then no more tax, and the gains will be tax-free and no minimum distribution requirements.
Okay. Now, what I'm getting is I'm with a mutual fund company, and I feel all this, and I have a small amount. I'm retired. I have a small amount of earned income, and I wanted to put more into that, and they said, no, you can only put in what your earned income is, roll over from my traditional IRA to my Roth IRA.
Well, that's correct. If, for example, in 2009, or 2008, you wanted to put $6,000 into an IRA, that's okay if you have $6,000 of earned income.
Okay.
If you have $3,000 of earned income, then you can only put in $3,000.
Thank you very much.
My right, pleasure.
Thank you. We'll try and get one more. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes. I just wanted to ask your guest what is his thoughts on the newly appointed by President-elect Obama Shapiro nomination for SEC chairman?
I think we'll have to wait and see. I think one of the things that Obama has done is he has appointed people, one, with significant experience, and two, very, very bright people. This particular person has a strong legal background, a strong regulatory background, And if you've been reading the Wall Street Journal the last couple of days, at least what they're saying about her is, does she have the intestinal fortitude? Is she strong enough to really tell that agency how it's going to be? She's apparently a very, very nice person, very talented, but extremely nice. And so there were some issues about, is she going to be tough enough to rein in, obviously, a regulatory body that has just been wildly out of touch?
We just real quick have somebody who has this question. Again, I think it's a question about taking money, rolling money from a traditional IRA to a Roth. Is the $100,000 that for an individual, or does that also count for individual and spouse? Does that
individual and spouse?
Okay.
Minute you hit $100,000, that's it.
All right. Well, hope that that helps. We're going to stop there with the promise that Dave will be back next month. Dave Sino is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, with us once a month, almost on a Friday, to talk about money management.
And thank you. Lots of great questions.
Yeah. Thanks to the listeners.